Good afternoon. My name is Angelia, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Another Set of Keys Unlocking the Doors to Mobility Options Beyond Driving conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. Ms. Tucker, you may begin your conference.
Thank you, Angelia. Hello, everyone. This is Lisa Tucker, and I'd like to welcome you to Another Set of Keys Unlocking the Doors to Mobility Options Beyond Driving. The National Center on Senior Transportation is proud to partner with the American Occupational Therapy Association in bringing you this distance learning event today. As a reminder to those participating for continuing education credits, you must be logged in on your own computer and telephone line. There can be no sharing of equipment for those of you applying for the CEUs. Also, you must remain on both the phone and web portions for the duration of the event. You will not receive credit if you leave early. Soon after today's webinar, you will all receive an email with links to the post-test and the two evaluations. You must complete all three of these by November 12th in order to qualify for the continuing education credits. Following the presentation today, we will answer some of the questions you submitted during the registration period, and if we have time, we'll open up and receive additional instructions from our operator, Angelia, on how you can ask a question of our presenters. At this time, I'm delighted to introduce Aylin Scholl Davis. Aylin has worked in the field of occupational therapy for over 25 years and currently serves as coordinator of the Older Driver Initiative with the American Occupational Therapy Association. She is a certified driving rehabilitation specialist, a member of the American Society on Aging Drive Well Speakers Bureau, and a CarFit instructor. At this time, I'm proud to turn things over to Aylin.
Thank you, Lisa. And welcome everybody onto our second NCST and AOTA sponsored webinar. We are thrilled to be getting information out to you on the topic of driving and commuter mobility. Just a quick slide on the Older Driver Initiative that AOTA has been the energy behind AOTA trying to help OTs get the information they need to increase our capacity to address the emerging senior driver needs, to advocate for people aging with medical conditions that may impact their safety and increase OT's role. We really are keeping in mind in this webinar today the frequently asked question that we've heard from OTs: what do I do if my client was told they can no longer drive? So as you go through the seminar today, think about that that's really the target question that we are trying to respond to in this webinar. I have the privilege of introducing our speakers. I am so thrilled that they enthusiastically agreed to speak when we called to invite them. You'll be hearing from, you'll be hearing from Dennis McCarthy. He is an assistant professor in the Occupational Therapy Department at Florida International University's FIU College of Nursing and Health Profession and an adjunct faculty member of FIU's Lehman Center for Transportation Research. I think I said that wrong. Oh, sorry, Dennis. Dr. McCarthy received his PhD in Rehabilitation Science from the University of Florida, a master's degree in education from Florida Atlantic University, and an undergraduate degree in occupational therapy from Florida International University. Dr. McCarthy's research interests include enabling safe community mobility for seniors and the disabled, which includes screening and assessment of safe driving behaviors and performance, pedestrian safety, and the use of alternative forms of transportation that enable people to safely and effectively obtain needed goods and services and participate in favored activities within the community. And I've delighted working with Dennis over the past 2 years as we've really worked on honing our areas of focus and expertise in this important area. The first speaker in your webinar will be Jenny Womack. She is a clinical associate professor for the Division of Occupational Science and Occupational Therapy at the University of North Carolina. Her 20-plus years of clinical experience, oh, it's fun to be up in that group, isn't it, Jenny? include work in rehabilitation, in physical rehabilitation, aging, community-based practice, and assistive technology. Specific to the realm of community mobility, she has served on municipal ADA and senior driver safety committees. Designed the paratransit eligibility system for the city of Raleigh, North Carolina. Think about these rules for OTs. Consults with aging service providers regarding alternative transportation. We need more of those. And is an event coordinator for the CARFID and the We Need to Talk programs. Professor Womack served on the original AOTA Specialty Certification Panel for Driving and Community Mobility. I'm absolutely delighted to turn the mic over to Jenny, and please listen to all the great things she has to say. Go for it, Jenny. You're on.
Thank you, Aylin. It's nice to be with everyone today. Thanks for making time in your busy schedules to spend an hour and a half with us. The first thing I want to do is turn back time a little bit, and so the slide you see there is sort of wishful thinking. Ideally, I think we wouldn't wait until a decision has been made that a client should no longer drive before we start addressing community mobility options and ways that people are going to stay engaged in their communities. And in many practice settings, I think it's possible to take a more proactive stance, particularly in continuing care retirement communities, assisted living facilities, work that we might do in the community with senior centers and other community-based options. If we have those options, there's several things I think that we can implement and continually be thinking about that would set us up well to address mobility transitions. One is that we continually assess driving-related factors for older adults, keeping aware of the functional limitations that most often interfere with driving and addressing those with people preventively and proactively. That we establish an open dialogue with our older clients about their current mobility within the community and their plans for the future, and talk about that in social ways, in group settings, as well as individually with people when we see them in more clinical settings. That we start getting a reading early on about how strong the connections are between the client's identity as a driver, their community involvement, and their performance as a driver. So for many people, it's a very strong role in something they dread having to give up eventually. For other people, it's something that they can make a fairly seamless transition out of. The other thing is that OTs participate in broad community-based discussions and programs about transportation options. So being aware of what's offered by social service providers, being involved in those conversations, being involved in transit planning kinds of conversations, and looking for those of you who are in more rural communities, from whom I know we've had a few questions, looking at what are the transportation gaps in your community and how might OTs be involved in helping to bridge some of those. So the basic idea is, ideally, we'd start transition planning very early with people and do it much more proactively. But without that option, most often we meet older clients when the decision has been made that they shouldn't drive any longer, or many times we're a part of the decision that results in driving cessation. So without that ability to address it more proactively, we have to start where we are. What I'm going to talk about for the next 20 minutes or so is a set of factors that you want to consider as we prepare to address community mobility options and transition to different community mobility. Sort of a background set, if you will, of things to think about. And then we want to move toward constructing a community mobility plan of action in consideration of those things. So the first background factor I think to think about won't be a surprise to anyone who works in this realm, and those are the emotional aspects of driving cessation. So we know that both the older driver and significant others can have emotional reactions to a driving cessation decision that spill over into their feelings about using other transportation alternatives or no longer being able to independently and spontaneously take themselves somewhere. It's in addition to sort of our knowledge of that on the ground, there are numerous studies that indicate there's an increase in depression following driving cessation. And there's also more recent research that questions the possibility of a link between driving cessation and overall declines in health. And so those are things we certainly want to stay aware of. The other thing that I find interesting is that those feelings of responsibility and grief, loss, or certainly burden can also surface among significant others. And that's a message to us to include them in our circle of care and to include them in conversations as we can regarding what the plans are for someone who has ceased to drive. The second factor is, again, sometimes a look backwards, and this may be a little bit of a surprising slide to see, but sometimes we need to revisit the driving cessation decision and ask ourselves and ask of our participants, who made the decision? Was it warranted? And those questions might be around the issues of, was it just a suggestion that the person stopped driving? Was it a decision that the client made out of some fear? Who made that decision in terms of, were they adequately assessed? Was there an evaluation done that was comprehensive enough to really determine that? And one of the reasons that this is important, about a decade ago, Jane Stutz and her colleagues here at the University of North Carolina, and then followed up by many people, started looking at this small subset of seniors who actually give up driving prematurely, and found that women in particular tend to do that, many because they can't imagine what improvements might keep them on the road or might help to remediate functional issues that interfere with driving. So we want to revisit that question with some clients and make sure that the driving cessation decision was adequately made. Following up to that, there may be driving skills that were amenable to remediation but weren't addressed in that manner. So you may be in a position, if you're in a more rehabilitative or outpatient or medical setting, that you may be in a position to help remediate deficits that interfered with driving that were temporary in nature, or that had to do with a situation the person was in rather than being a long-term issue. So that should lead us to the question, is referral to a driving rehabilitation specialist indicated? If they weren't involved in the initial driving cessation decision, and you believe with your clinical judgment that the person needs revisiting from that aspect, then perhaps referral to a driver rehabilitation specialist is indicated. The third factor to consider as sort of a background in helping someone plan community mobility alternatives is to think about, were you a part of the driving cessation decision? And if so, you need to consider your effectiveness in counseling regarding transportation alternatives or options after the fact. So are you and the client responding to one another in a positive way in the current time, or at least an objective way? Or is there so much ill will or anger or feelings of loss that it's not going to be effective for you to be the one to counsel regarding alternative transportation? So ask yourself who else might be helpful in the conversation. If you have team members like social work, psychology, that may be of help, sometimes just another team member that the client responds to more effectively, you know, a nurse, a physical therapist, a physician. Are there friends or family members who've been intimately involved in this decision, or actually who may have a little more distance from it that might be helpful in talking about it with the client? Do you have options for other OT practitioners to be involved? So are you an OTR-OTA partnership that one of you might have a more effective communication with the client at the time of driving cessation? Or could you shift the referral to another OT practitioner if that's needed? And the last thing to consider in this factor is just, do you and your client need some time to regroup? The one thing I hear from driver rehabilitation specialists is it's very hard to address the issue of transportation alternatives at the time you give the information that you've made a recommendation for driving cessation. That's not when the person is typically most receptive to hear those kinds of options. So think about rescheduling that, and again, acting proactively. If you know you're going to be giving that kind of information, if you're involved in the driving cessation decision, then think about when you want to start talking about community mobility options, and preferably before it comes to that point. The fourth background factor to consider before we move on to constructing the plan of action is the role of significant others. So we spoke a little bit about the emotional response and the grief and the burden that sometimes significant others experience, but also consider their relative strengths in the situation. They may be in a position to help diffuse negative emotion around the situation. They might also be able to offer some tangible assistance in terms of provision of rides or assistance in talking through the options. And they may be the most aware people in terms of other resources pertinent to the issue, so the finances of the social network, opportunities for ride sharing and connections. We always, of course, have to consider the wishes of the client relative to the involvement of others. But if that's amenable to people, then involving significant others, family members, friends in the discussion is often helpful. So with those background factors in mind, let's move toward constructing a community mobility plan of action. And one thing I'd like to stress is that this is the same process that you're familiar with in other OT evaluation and treatment processes. It's a very sequential stepwise procedure. The first step being collect information, identifying problem areas, from those problem areas confirming priorities for the client, then determining available resources that may be helpful in terms of addressing the problem areas and establishing a plan of action. But in this case, we'll talk specifically relative to how someone moves about and engages in the world outside their home. So step one, collecting information. I typically begin with the question, where does someone typically travel, and put it into a temporal context, sometimes daily, weekly, monthly, depending on the activity level of the person and how much I know about their movement about in the community. For each destination that they identify, I want to know how they currently travel to that destination, primarily because I want to know how automobile dependent they are. Have they ever tried any other types of community mobility? Are they mobile in other ways outside the automobile? Are they someone who likes to walk or ever walks or bikes to a destination? I also want to know how often they travel to the destination. How much of a routine and a habit is it within their lives? And that will relate to how much loss they may feel when they stop driving. With whom do they travel, including whether or not they provide transportation to other people, how far the destination is from their home. So I'd like to know, how often do they travel farther than 10 miles away from their home, and how often are they traveling within a relatively small circle that may be easier to address in terms of planning alternatives? Really importantly, what occupations are they engaging in within the travel? Because I'd like to stress that this is not just an issue of finding alternatives for transportation, but it's really an issue of finding alternate options, adaptations, for people to stay engaged and involved in the kinds of the things that they like to do, not just finding the transportation to do those things. And really, of prime importance to me is, can the client themselves identify any alternate means of traveling to the destination? Because client-identified options, in most cases, are more likely to be followed up on. They may be unaware of resources, which is where our knowledge is going to come in. But if they can suggest something, it's often the first thing that they might follow up on. And step two, identifying the problem areas. So which destinations and occupations that have been identified in step one are particularly dependent upon automobile travel? So once that's been mapped out and you understand how they get places and how often they're using the automobile, we want to look at how dependent they are on and being the primary driver. Which destinations and occupations are typically done alone? So in other words, where is there no social support? There may be some obvious options if other people are traveling with them, but if they're traveling alone, they may not be able to identify those options so readily. Also, are there destinations for which the client was providing transportation to others? So we want to think about, not only is this a loss of their own independent driving abilities, but they often lose a benefactor role, and consider the possibility of some grief around that, and also possibly some shame around the inability to continue providing the service. So start thinking about ways that this might be alternately addressed. So not just how does the person continue to travel, but how do they continue to be a giver or a benefactor? In step three, we want to confirm the client priorities. So we've identified the problem areas and listed as part of our plan of action, where they travel, et cetera. But we want to know now which destinations represent occupations or social connections that the client most values, and those are going to move to the top of the list for intervention. One of the things that I found, it's often hard for people to say directly what's most important to them, because when driving cessation comes about, everything is important. Just the loss of being able to travel anywhere often makes it difficult to talk about what may be most valuable. But there are a lot of clues that come out in conversation with older adults. So listen for things like phrases that people are saying, I would die if I had to give up X, or my life won't be the same if I can't do so and so. And those are often the things that they're trying to tell you without knowing consciously themselves, maybe the most important things to address first. And to make it feasible within a clinical setting, target 1 to 3 of those most important destinations to address in planning mobility options. Step 4 is determining available resources. And there are 4 broad categories to address in this, so there'll be 2 slides related to this. The first category to consider is personal resources, so identifying friends or family members who can or will provide rides, but also talking, and sometimes this can be sensitive, but talking about financial resources that may be used to pay for a driver or to pay for alternative transportation, and then looking at social connections of the person. Are there people who travel to the same places that they do and that may be able to help out with providing some modified or alternate transportation? So those personal resources are the first category. The second category would be existing community transportation options. And I've listed there things that Dennis is going to cover more in the next section of the conference. But I'd like to just note here that rural communities have special challenges in this regard, and they necessitate looking at informal as well as these existing more formal options. We'll address some of that in the question and answer session, but certainly want to give a nod to the fact that often fixed route public transportation and paratransit may not be as accessible in the rural areas. But I would like to know if is a community or the immediate area in which the person lives walkable? And also a really important question, what existing options match the client's current abilities? Because we'll repeat several times in this seminar that the same functional limitations that keep someone from driving often keep them from adequately or effectively using community mobility options. So those are the first two categories in this step four, is personal resources and community transportation options. The third category I'd like to talk about are possible new transportation options or modifying an occupation so that it doesn't necessarily require transportation. So does the social network around an occupation and a destination lend itself to forming a carpool or sort of a shared ride system? Are there other people involved in the situation that could provide a new transportation option? Can transportation be traded for another service? I worked for a while in low-income housing for older adults in which one resident provided rides to the grocery store every week for two other residents who knit for her and cooked for her. And that sort of bartering system in an informal way allowed a new transportation option for the two people who were no longer drivers. Do some destination sites offer transportation? And by this I mean transportation that's provided by destination sites refers to services or businesses that provide transportation for their members or their customers in order to retain their involvement. So it may be a faith community or a church that offers transportation so that they keep their members engaged in church. It may be a store that offers transportation so that they keep customers coming to their area. This is a much more informal kind of way of operating, and within your own communities, you need to look and see whether or not those things exist. The final category is restructuring occupations to be less mobility dependent. Can groceries or prescriptions be delivered rather than the person driving to get them? Could some sort of social engagement, like a card game, be moved to the client's home rather than them needing to drive to someone else's home for it? And could a church or social meeting in which the client engages occur during the day when there's transit available rather than at night when it doesn't run? And I want to acknowledge in saying this that this is not easy. We offer these sort of bulleted points of things that you might do, but it's never easy to work with someone who's giving up driving and just make a totally smooth transition. So we want to acknowledge that it's a tough thing to do, but these are all strategies that you might think about employing and think in these four broad categories. Step five here is to establish a plan of action, or as in any occupational therapy process, to establish the goals and what's going to happen in the intervention process. So the OT practitioner's preparation for this is going to necessitate that, as in any process, we consider client factors that led to driving cessation and how those same factors are going to affect the use of other transportation options. So mobility, cognition, vision, endurance. And some of you listening post questions beforehand about options for seniors with specific issues like low vision or dementia. Those specifics are beyond the scope of what we're trying to do today, but there are some resources in the supplemental materials that are provided on the NCST website that will be helpful in that regard. We also want to know, in preparation for intervention, is does the client need support or training for using other forms of transportation related to their client factors that led to this? And then also considering their contextual resources and challenges related to transportation needs, we don't want to make expensive recommendations if the person doesn't have the financial resources. We certainly have to consider their geographic context and their social context when we're making recommendations for things like shared riding or the use of certain geographic options that are less available in rural areas than in urban. And finally, we really need to develop awareness of our own community resources. One of the first places to start when working with seniors is at the Department on Aging and the area agencies on aging that sponsor programs throughout each state. Also, being aware of supplemental transportation providers, those more informal, sometimes community-based providers. And again, Dennis is going to provide more information about this. But being aware of those entities that exist within our communities, we need to know about the transit systems that are available to us, as well as the social service agencies that provide transportation. And sometimes social service agencies may provide transportation only for very specific reasons, like medical appointments or only going for grocery and medical. But there is often some transportation available through the Division of Social Services or the Department on Social Services in your area. And then we also need to be aware of what private options are going on, especially if we work in more residential settings. Are there some informal social networks forming around transportation and around offering rides, and how might we support those and also, you know, be aware of the liabilities associated with those? In terms of establishing a plan of action on the client's part, we might think about this in terms of the same factors, client factors, that limited their ability to be drivers might need remediation in terms of facilitating their ability to do things like contacting a community transportation provider, completing an application for paratransit, negotiating transportation with a friend, or organizing an alternative way to engage in their valued occupation that eliminates their dependence on driving. So thinking about cognitive factors, visual factors, mobility factors that have limited their ability to drive also need to be addressed in terms of their possible actions on their own behalf. But our role is to empower and facilitate these things happening. And the desired outcome of that is certainly the continued involvement of the client in their valued occupations in the community and implementing various strategies for related transportation needs. Now, I'm sorry that the PDF itself is not visible here, but we've included in the supplemental materials section a pilot tool I've used to gather the information I've mentioned in the previous stages of developing a community action plan. And you're welcome to use it if you find it helpful. On the supplemental materials list, it's called the Community Mobility Grid and has my last name, Womack, attached to it. It's in a PDF file, and you're welcome to copy it. There's also an example of how I've used it to fill out information about destinations and frequency of travel, and hope you'll find it useful as an occupation-based community mobility assessment. So in summary, relative to this part, we want to be proactive about addressing community mobility options with all clients, regardless of their current driving status, and to assess current community mobility status and dependence upon various forms of transportation. We want to carry out a process like any other occupational therapy evaluation and treatment planning process, but focus specifically on community mobility. And I realize it may sound a little bit taken for granted, but I was amazed looking back once I started working more in community mobility, how much in rehabilitation settings and in skilled nursing facilities and in assisted living facilities that I had not included community mobility as part of my initial evaluation, that often I was very focused on personal mobility, the ability to transfer and the person's balance and their ability to, you know, mobilize themselves in a home environment. But including a community mobility piece in an initial evaluation will give us a lot of information proactively we can hopefully use down the road if and when the person faces driving cessation. And I think it goes without saying that we all need to keep in mind the psychosocial factors associated with living in an automobile-dependent society. I have never worked with anyone who's very gladly given up keys to an automobile. I have worked with some people for whom it wasn't a difficult transition, but there are many people for whom it's quite a loss. And so keeping in mind that the context that we all live in the United States is very automobile-dependent, and that it is quite a transition for people to give that up. So if nothing else, what people have told me many times is that they appreciated the support just to think about other options, even if what I thought might work for them was not the same thing that they eventually ended up using. I hope that this part's been helpful to you, and I look forward to Dennis offering you some more concrete options around transportation alternatives. And the last slide that you'll see from me are references for part one, and I'll be back in the question and answer session. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Jenny. Dennis, we'll turn to you now.
Okay, well, thanks very much. Thank you, Jenny. That was very interesting. Whereas Jenny took the perspective of the client, more or less, I'm going to be talking more about the transit options that are available for us. First, though, I'd like to go over a couple of terms that might be useful. In the literature and otherwise, we have defined a trip as a one-way travel. And so this is a kind of important if you're thinking about the different modes of transportation and how people might get around. So we consider a trip to be from one destination to another. So the home to the grocery store, for example, would be one trip. And if we came back home again, that would be two trips. So you know, we might tend to think of that as a single round trip, but for our purposes, let's think of that as two trips. So if we threw in another destination along the way, say going to the bank before we came home from the grocery store, then that would make it three trips. So this is important when we think about the concept of trip chaining, when we are able to combine more than one destinations during an outing. And this this concept of travel training is highly dependent on the type of mode that we travel mode that we are able to select. Obviously, an automobile would give us much more opportunity to do trip chaining than a fixed route bus or subway might. In addition, we have to think about the types and levels of service as these vary among the transportation options too. So types of services, we have fixed route, which these vehicles operate on a fixed schedule. They have fixed destinations, and there's no variability among them. Flexible routes, they also have a set schedule and somewhat fixed route. However, they do have the capability of varying off that route. And in some cases, some fixed route services have become flexible route services in order to accommodate needs of the disabled or the seniors as well. And the last category would be demand response. And this would be a type of service where you would have to call up in advance and book your ride. It's generally a shared ride, meaning that there'll be other passengers going to other destinations in your vehicle. So the levels of service also need to be considered. These are curb to curb. An example to this might be public transportation bus or subway system, where you would have to walk from the curb to get there, and the transportation service would drop you off at the curb, and there'd be additional walking component to get to your final destination. A door to door would be an example might be a taxi cab, which pulls into your driveway or at the curbside to pick you up, and you've got to get out of your house, get into the taxi or your friend's car before you can travel. A door-through-door is a much higher level of service. This would be for someone who might need assistance to get out of the house, down the stairs, might need a little help into the car. Maybe, the mobility device might need help with that. And escort services are a step further than that. These types of services might accompany the passenger or the rider to their destination. Say they may come into the house, help the person transfer off the couch into the wheelchair, bring them to the car, help transfer into the car, stow the mobility device, do the opposite at the doctor's office, and maybe even accompany the person into the doctor's office and perhaps take notes on what the doctor has to say. So you can see there's obviously different levels of service. Escort services, very intense one-to-one types of services, which obviously could also be very, very costly. So just as in other aspects of our discipline, we have certain interventions available to us to address deficits. And the same thing goes for deficits in commuter mobility. We have just a short list of compensatory strategies, and these are our transportation options. So sometimes it makes it a little bit easier to understand knowing that there's a finite list. And sometimes this concept of public transportation or transportation in general can seem overwhelming, but it really is a finite list and varies among areas. So our options really are public transportation, where it exists, paratransit services, specialized transportation, commercial and human service transportation, walking as transportation, and getting rides from others. And we'll talk about each one of these here. So first of all, public transportation typically will include buses, but it also might include some type of rail, light rail, shuttles, people movers, things like that. They are fixed route, set schedule, curb-to-curb service. So all of these have implications for your clients. Are they able to, you know, walk to the destination, et cetera? Generally speaking, they're low cost to the operator and to the user. Many communities offer discounts for seniors. Here in Miami-Dade County, seniors are able to ride for free. They're usually present in urban and some suburban areas. However, they're rare in rural areas. And one study shows that 65% of seniors have limited or no access to public transportation. But even when it is available, seniors tend not to use it. It accounts for less than 5% of all senior trips, and seniors represent less than 7% of all public transportation riders. And part of this, there's many reasons, part of it is that many seniors are unaware of the services that are available. So if we go back to the person then, of course, we're going to, Jenny mentioned also that a lot of the things that contribute to driving cessation may also prevent successful transitioning to transportation options. And this slide kind of talks a little bit about those. You know, the functional abilities required for public transportation use would be physical functioning. And I mentioned too, you know, you've got to walk to the bus stop, and you've got to, at your destination, you have to walk from the bus stop to wherever you're going. So there is a physical component to each end of public transportation use. There's other factors too, waiting at the bus stop, climbing the steps of the bus. Now, these are all considerations. Cognitive abilities might have been affected that caused driving cessation, and could also interfere with things like you know, planning your route, or making transfers from one bus route to another. Vision might play an issue. You've got to read the bus schedules, recognize your stops. And there's also psychosocial issues, too. You're riding in a car, you can be pretty much independent by yourself, but if you're taking public transportation, you're going to have to interact with other passengers and with the operator. And there's going to be unexpected situations that you might have to deal with, too. So there are not only real, but there are also perceived barriers to the use of public transportation, which keep many people from using these services. Some real barriers might include the shelter. Again, here in Florida, you know, we've got a lot of bus stops with no shelter whatsoever from the sun or from the rains in the summertime. So that would certainly deter a person from using it. Could be the walking distances from your home to the bus stop, wait times and not knowing when the next bus is going to arrive can keep people from using these systems. And there are limited destinations. A lot of the public transportation systems are set up for commuters rather than for seniors to be able to engage in activities or destinations that are more popular for them. But there's also a lot of perceived barriers that may not be real that keep seniors from making this transition. Seniors tend to think of public transportation as being unsafe, dirty, it's untimely, unreliable, and they think it's costly too. Again, a lot of these are perceived barriers. We've interviewed many people here in Miami-Dade County who are users and non-users of public transportation. And we've found that non-users have these negative perceptions about the unsafe, untimely, dirty, where the users do not express these perceptions about the system. They think it's very safe, efficient, clean. So it's really the perceptions that may be keeping a lot of seniors from making the transition from driving a car to using public transportation. Okay, so if you have public transportation available in your area, how can you help to promote senior mobility among your clients? Well, first, there's this concept of travel training. This is originated in New York by a person who was looking to enable children with disabilities to ride to school independently. So this is a service that provides one-on-one, individualized travel instruction in travel skills. So it includes the trainer riding with the client using the system until they're able to confidently use the system by themselves. Sometimes even just the not knowing how to pay for a bus ride would prevent a person from ever trying to get on the bus. Travel trainers typically work in the community. They're employed by schools. They may be employed by human service organizations, for-profits, transportation agencies, and other areas too. So you may find travel trainers through public transportation agencies, local human service organizations, area agencies on aging. And there's also, on this slide, there's a website that lists the Association of Travel Instructors instruction. And there's a number of people that are listed on there that provide these types of services. So you could see if someone is in your area and refer your clients to a travel trainer. Other ways for promoting public transportation use is just talking with our clients to let them know that the locus of control can be with them. If they can become independent public transportation users, then they're in control. They remain independent. They don't have to rely on other people to provide rides for them. We could work with travel agencies or travel transit agencies to increase their senior friendliness. In order for seniors to use them, more ergonomic vehicles to get in and out of or to store things on. We could also do bus operator sensitivity training for seniors. There's this concept of bus buddies where we could turn travel into like a social event. So if we've got two or three people going to the same destination, say the mall, for example, we could turn it into some type of social event as well. And there's a lot of promising technology out there that is present today and will be in the near future that could provide a lot of assistance for seniors using public transit. Already we've got many public transportation services provide web-based instruction to get from one destination to another, so you can plug in your beginning and ending destination, and it'll tell you where to transfer, how much it'll cost, etc. There's technology that can tell us when the next bus is going to arrive, so we know if we know when to leave the house if we have to wait in the hot sun or something like that. So technology holds promise for many of these things. Paratransit is our next option. Paratransit was required by the Americans with Disabilities Act it's required to provide transportation services for people who cannot use public transportation. So you'll find paratransit only where public transportation exists. There are eligibility requirements to determine if a person cannot use public transportation. But this is usually based on the person's ability rather than the presence of a disability. And it could also be a temporary condition as well. However, paratransit services are usually dependent on the proximity to the fixed route system. Here in Miami-Dade County, for example, one has to live within a half a mile of the fixed route system in order to be eligible for paratransit services. So if you live just a little bit outside that window, then paratransit services are not offered for you. Paratransit services usually provide vans or wheelchair-accessible vans. More and more often, these services are being subcontracted to taxi companies, and it's considered a flexible route door-to-door service. For operators, paratransit services are very expensive to operate. Rides can typically cost $35 or more per trip for operators, where public transportation can cost $1.50 or maybe $2 per trip. So there's a financial incentive for paratransit providers to transition folks to public transportation systems. And one way of doing this is through the use of travel trainers. So paratransit services might employ travel trainers to try and transition some people from paratransit to public transportation. Also, they're changing the buses. They're now what's known as kneeling buses. They're buses without stairs that are able to lower the frame of the bus so the person doesn't have to step up as high. So they're making the physical demands and other demands of the public transportation less to try and help some folks use them. So paratransit services, I mentioned before, it's a demand response service. It requires 24-hour notice, and it's a shared ride. So the problems with this is it sometimes can take a very long time to get to your destination. If there are other riders riding along with you, they may be dropped off before you are, or you might have to stop and pick up someone along the way. So planning your routes and destinations and times can be very difficult and very frustrating. And these are essentially one trip, you know, per plan. So once you get to your destination, you also have to plan the trip on going home and face the same barriers of shared rides and not knowing exactly when you're going to get home or to your destination. They most likely don't assist with packages, and they provide only door-to-door services. So if the client needs a higher level of services, then paratransit is probably not going to work for them. A study by the Beverly Foundation showed that paratransit does not replace mobility. Less than 25% of people who are eligible to use paratransit used it. So paratransit is an option, but it's certainly not the answer. There are specialized transportation services that are probably available in your community that you may not know about. These types of services usually provide rides from the person's home to a particular destination. So adult day services, for example, you get a ride, they'll pick you up and bring you to the senior center or adult day services. Or hospital-based transportation will bring you to the hospital for therapy. But generally speaking, they're not going to stop at the grocery store or the drugstore on their way home. So they're really special destination-type services. And they certainly can provide some services, too. Again, if, you know, they might pick a person up, bring them to the senior center so they can have a meal. So that certainly supplements the person's ability to travel. But again, not an answer. But a lot of these, again, might exist in your communities that you're not aware of. So your job would be to identify what these are. Walking for seniors, walking for everyone in our country is a second only to the car for transportation. However, we really don't walk very much. Walking accounts for less than 10% of all trips by seniors. And again, it requires physical ability, stamina, functional abilities that we talked about that may have contributed to driving cessation. And if you think about it too, walking, you have to have destinations to walk to if you're using walking as transportation. So rural areas are not likely to have a lot of people walking as transportation. We need sidewalks and safe areas in order to walk as well. So the built environment is very important if we're considering walking as a transportation alternative. And what's notable here, too, is that seniors face a higher risk of death or injury as a pedestrian than they do as a driver. So if we're going to promote walking for seniors, we need to make sure that their walking environment is safe. And then there are other options, too, bicycling, which again, very low percentage of seniors will use. And then more and more often, senior retirement communities are promoting the use of golf carts as a method to get around within the community. Then we have commercial transportation, taxis, limousines, things like this. What's most attractive about these is that it's the most similar mode to the private car, so we can go where we want to, when we want to. We can make spontaneous decisions rather than calling up 24 hours in advance for paratransit. We can just get on the phone and call a taxi. However, again, very low usage rate among seniors. One study showed less than 1% of seniors use taxis. And again, just like public transportation, we've got real and perceived barriers. Some of the barriers listed in the literature include wait times, reliability, driver issues, not being familiar with how to use the system, how to pay, how you get charged. A lot of times seniors say they don't know if they have taxi services available in their area. Sometimes the vehicle design, back to ergonomics, might make it difficult for a senior to use a taxi. And then there's a lot of taxi companies do not allow drivers to provide assistance with packages or mobility devices. But there also can be facilitators too, because it actually shows that that there is a generally high satisfaction rate with the use of taxis. There's the flexibility, very easy to do trip chaining with taxis, and there are some that do help with packages and mobility devices. Okay, so maybe taxis is the answer. So what can we do to promote taxi use? Well, first thing we can do is address this the perceived cost barriers of using a taxi. And the way one might do this is just to inform the client about the cost of owning and operating your own car. And the Hartford Transportation Cost Worksheet is one way to do this. AAA estimates that it costs about $9,500 a year to own and operate a car. So I went online on the taxifarefinder.com and figured out a trip from campus here to nearby Coral Gables, and figured I could do 11 round trips a month for that amount of money. So if you put it in perspective, it may not seem so expensive to a senior if they're aware of how much their private car is costing them. And what's become recently more popular too is our programs that provide seniors with taxi vouchers or discounted taxi fares. What we found in a study here in South Florida, though, was that because of the perceived barriers of taxi use, there has to be an educational component if there's going to be a successful taxi voucher program. What we found is that that the taxi voucher program did not attract any new users to taxis. However, what it did was subsidize current taxi users. So again, it's essential that the educational component of using the taxi system be combined with a taxi voucher program. And again, other barriers to just unfamiliarity. Sometimes taxis will do shared rides. And then, of course, there could be some issues with the drivers, too. So there are some National Center for Senior Transportation did a project where they did some senior sensitivity training for taxi drivers. Okay, so the most common method of getting around other than driving is getting a ride from somebody else. Generally, it's going to be a spouse or a daughter or daughter-in-law, and there might also be friends. Under this category, too, it could be paid or volunteer driver programs. These are known as supplemental transportation programs, and these are commonly operated by faith-based or nonprofit or human service organizations. And again, there may be one or more of these types of services available in your community that's kind of under the radar, that they, you know, may be providing rides for their members. So the word isn't necessarily out there that these services even exist. So it would be your job, again, to search your communities to see if these types of programs exist there. There are various models of volunteer driver programs. I'm going to talk briefly about one in a second. And then there are some like volunteer service organizations that could provide rides too, like Red Cross, American Cancer Society, Veterans Administration, things like that. All right, so if getting rides from others is the number two way of getting around, then how can we help our clients get rides from others? Well, first of all, we have to recognize the barriers, once again, to getting rides from others. And, you know, people don't want to be a burden on their family or friends, so they have feelings of dependency. Plus, if a person asks someone for a ride, they're asking for a favor, so there's a sense of obligation, too, that that might come along with asking for a ride. And there's a perception that, you know, they have to rely on other people for transportation needs, which affects their self-esteem. And so, again, it can be a difficult situation. So what we like to do is to empower seniors to ask for rides. And Jenny mentioned this before about it with a barter system. So if there's something that a senior can do for someone else who can give them a ride, they can certainly barter in that way. The TRIP Volunteer Driver Program is the one I mentioned earlier, and this program is quite unique in that it provides mileage reimbursement to the passengers, to the people who need rides, rather than to the drivers. So this system of payment empowers the senior to ask for rides. So instead of asking for a favor, the senior can say, "Hey, I need a ride to the doctor next Tuesday. I can reimburse you for your mileage if you can give me a ride." So the senior's not asking for a favor; they're not obligated to that person, and it makes it much more powerful. So they can really control their own transportation methods. So, and then the other ways to do this, obtaining rides from others and using other public other transportation options, is to address and dispel the perceived barriers we have, but address the real barriers as well. So our goals then as occupational therapists with regard to community mobility is the first one, the one I mentioned a couple times already. You have to be knowledgeable about transportation options in your area. And it's not a matter of looking things up in the yellow pages. Sometimes these services are not widely known, but that does not mean they don't exist in your area. And this is especially important for rural areas, which we know don't have public transportation and therefore don't have paratransit services. Again, there may be informal networks that exist, and you're just not aware of them yet. So once you identify the transportation options in your area, you have to know how to connect your clients with these options. Ideally, what we'd like to do would be to develop a menu of transportation options for our clients to use. So rather than relying on one method, say getting a ride from a daughter, if we could get a person to take a bus to the hairdressers, maybe a taxi to the grocery store so they can put the groceries in the back, and maybe they go for dialysis, so maybe that's appropriate for paratransit. This way, they become familiar with the family of transportation options and not have to rely on one particular mode all the time. Jenny mentioned also, I think we should be encouraging people to think about transitioning from driving earlier. At least when a person has the functional ability to be able to learn how to use the new systems. Again, we often wait too late for people when they're forced to stop driving. They may not have the functional ability to learn new methods. So if we can transition them earlier, I think we'd be much more successful. We need to assist our clients to gain confidence, to practice using these different transportation options, and getting experienced, And doing all this will enable our clients to remain engaged and active in our community and contributing to our community as well. Okay, so some considerations then for transportation options is eligibility. You know, is a person able to use the system based on their needs? Is it affordable? So what's the cost of the system compared to the resources of the person? And accessibility, what type of accessibility issues do we need to consider with this? There is this concept of mobility managers, which may or may not exist in your area. Oftentimes these might be available through area agencies on aging, and this would be a person who can guide a client through the transportation resources and services that are available and try and match the client's needs to the available options. And so once you identify these, then we need to ask, this is the questions we ask the program. So you know, when do they run? Where's the service area? Some services don't go across county lines, for example. Are there limits to the rides or destinations or purpose of the trip? You know, are trips only for medical necessity, or can they be also for life enriching activities too? Is there assistance available for packages, mobility devices? Is there additional assistance available for maybe those with cognitive disabilities or visual disabilities? And is pre-registration required? All right, so in summary then, we have a limited list of transportation options that are available to us, and other than receiving rides from family and friends, the other options are generally not used because of perceived and real barriers. You need to be knowledgeable about the options available, and your intervention should focus on keeping folks independent in their communities. Okay.
Thank you, Dennis. Thank you so much, Dennis and Jenny. I'm sitting here talking to Lisa and Lucinda and saying I'm so excited. I think this is really, you've really nailed some very important information. Just to wrap up and conclude with a few ideas. We're talking here about what we do when there's no more driving. Did I get my little acronym of AUTO? I was monkeying around with this slide. But we really need, as Dennis and Jenny so carefully said, we need to ask questions. It's an occupational therapy's obligation. It's our duty to make sure that we're asking the right questions so that we can be assisting people with safe mobility. We need to understand their impairment and its impact on essential skills and abilities. We need to think about this transitioning, and I hope that you are really thinking much more broadly, possibly, than you may have been. I certainly am, after listening to Jenny and Dennis, really thinking about what transition means. And as occupational therapists, I hope that we can be seen as a valuable part of the team and hopefully be able to receive clients where there's some concern about transportation and assist them in these manners. Again, as they so well described, it really takes a village. I hope that as Jenny and Dennis went through their steps, you were thinking about I'm certainly hoping from AOTA's perspective that occupational therapists will assume some of this role looking at driving. But also, it's not all about us. It's about really accessing and working with the providers in our communities, really working together with transit providers, with the different professionals that are available to us. And I would need to direct you to the AOTA Older Driver website for a number of resources that they talked about and that are available to you, and also we will be posting information about accessing this webinar in the future. So just need to plug that, and I also want to take a quick moment to have a brief commercial on our Older Driver Safety Awareness Week that's coming up in December. And really, I'm encouraging all occupational therapists to think about participating, which means doing something to address safe mobility for seniors during that week or in the proximity of that week and letting us know about it that week so that we can increase visibility about this important area for seniors. I wanted to respond to a couple of the advanced questions that we got before we move into our Q&A portion. What was that? Okay. The Driving Transition Education resource is a NHTSA publication, and it's one resource that's available to you as you're listening to these different breakdown of what driving transportation alternatives might involve. These are scripts, talking points, and resources that you could use if you're both wanting to speak more on the topic and be able to communicate this to your clients. And lastly, I wanted to respond to the advanced question that we've had looking specifically at dementia and driving. Dementia requires, as we all know, a very specific intervention and a specific approach. And I think that looking at the Beverly Foundation website, when Dennis was talking about door-through-door and arm-through-arm types of transportation, the resource called the Dementia-Friendly Transportation Calculator is a wonderful resource for you to access on their website that walks you through these different criteria, putting it in the context of working with a person with dementia. It's a very, I think it's a very useful resource to help you frame your intervention. The other question that I often receive, and I'm just going to use as kind of a lead out, and then we'll move to Lisa opening up to questions and answers, has to do with reimbursement. And I would just pose to the audience to think about, as Dennis and Jenny so carefully outlined the components of looking at safe mobility for people with medical conditions or with some concerns or aging, think about that reimbursable intervention has to be justified, that it requires the skills and expertise of an occupational therapist. I think that some of the information that was reviewed in this webinar might assist you with thinking about how you and your intervention services might distinguish what is skilled intervention, therapeutic intervention, and what could be more of a community-based service. So with those thoughts, I'm going to turn the mic over to Lisa, and again, thank you, Jenny and Dennis. I think you did just a phenomenal job.
Absolutely, I agree. Thanks, Aylin. As Aylin did mention, we did have a few questions come in advance of the event today, and she had addressed one of the themes that came through regarding dementia and transportation. Another question that we received several on is about rural issues and transportation, and we know there's a lot of challenges there, and there's varying levels of transportation services in our rural areas. And so the speakers have had a chance to think about this, and so now I would like to put it to you all, Jenny and Dennis and Aylin, if you have anything to add, if you all would care to address the rural issues and transportation topic.
So this is Jenny. I'll be glad to start with that one. There are three things that I think I would do in looking at rural transportation options, and this is a item that's close to my heart. I grew up rurally and love actually working in rural areas. So the first thing I do is find out what is officially available, and that may not be so easy to figure out how to pursue, but places that I would look are county social service offices and extension agents who are in the community, agricultural and home economics extension agencies, those sort of county offices or parish offices if you're in a state with parishes that may know something about the services that are offered or may actually help provide some of them. There are also ways to find out formally what's happening in your state. So every state has a rural transportation office. They're called RTAP offices. You can search that online and find out who the contact is in your state. Those offices are responsible for determining how rural transportation is going to occur. Now, granted, they're limited funds, and they're often widely distributed, but there are state initiatives in every state relative to that. There are also a couple of places to look online that you can find out who your area agency on aging might be, and that's a really important component to tap into. One is to look at eldercare.gov, and that was on Dennis's slides that you'll receive, the link to that. That allows you to search by zip code or area for the contact information for your area agency on aging. The other place you might look is at 211.org, which is the United Way referral network service. It will tell you basically if there is a 211 system in your area that people can call into and find out information about all kinds of services, transportation included. The other thing that I would do is to find out what is informally available by talking with your client, by finding out sort of circles that they travel in, because rurally I found that many things happen through faith communities and through social networks that people are involved in other ways. There are some really creative things that happen in rural communities around transportation, including the senior who has the car realizes that they have a pretty valuable resource, and they find a driver who needs a car and make that barter with one another. So looking at informal networks that are available through faith communities, through service providers, through social networks that the client already has. The third thing I do is think about how you might be involved in creating things in your rural communities or in rural communities that you serve. There are programs out there funded by the federal government that provide vouchers for people who will serve as volunteer drivers in rural areas. And a lot of that is coordinated through the Research and Training Center on Disability in Rural Communities at the University of Montana. And that's a mouthful, but I'm just going to say it again in case you want to search it. It's the Research and Training Center on Disability in Rural Communities through the University of Montana. And that may be helpful to you to find out what kind of options there are for actually looking at grants if you're involved in agencies that may be interested in creating something in your rural community.
Thanks so much, Jenny. That's a lot of great stuff. Dennis, did you have anything to add to the rural issues?
Well, I think Jenny covered it very well. I just would emphasize, too, that that some services may exist in the area, and it might seem overwhelming to try and locate them, but the efforts would really pay off to find out what's available. I would also add that if we're talking about occupational therapists getting involved with creating transportation options, then I would certainly want to mention the value of volunteer driver programs, in particular the TRIP program, TRIP, which is based out of Riverside, California, has a very cost-effective model. That's the one I described before that provides reimbursement to the rider so they can ask drivers for rides. Very inexpensive program to operate, and would probably be one of the better options for developing transportation options in a rural area.
Great, thank you. And thanks to the fact that our presenters are so well organized, we do have time to take some live questions today. One very important note, I would like to request that callers refrain from naming the transit systems or the cities or towns that you're speaking about so we can maintain confidentiality. At this time, I'd like to ask our operator, Angelia, to provide instructions on how participants can unmute their phones and pose live questions to our presenters. Angelia?
At this time, I would like to remind everyone, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster.
Thanks, Angelia. And while we're waiting for the queue to come up, I would like to introduce my colleague here at the National Center on Senior Transportation, Lucinda Shannon. And Lucinda has some experience and knowledge about a program in Maryland that we were thinking you all might like to know about. And it was triggered to us when Dennis mentioned the barter system. And so I'd like to ask Lucinda to tell us about that.
Thanks, Lisa. Hi, everybody. Partners in Care is similar to the TRIP program, where it really empowers the rider. And what it is it's a nonprofit in Maryland, in a rural area in Maryland, and it's a time-sharing network. So you can volunteer to put your time in as a handyman, as a cook. They have a store. You can work in the store, a thrift shop, or volunteer drive, and then you put your time in, and then you get time out from somebody else in the network who is also volunteering. So if you are no longer, driving, you might want to go put a few hours in, working at the store. They had one woman who, it's very empowering to the people because it's not charity, it's an opportunity to contribute to your community and be involved with your community, but also get services that you need. So everybody's putting in a little bit. They had one woman who needed an. They were like, "What can you do?" And she was like, "I can't do anything." And you know, they were like, "Well, you know, they saw she had afghans in her home, so she knitted an afghan." And they raffled it off and raised a ton of money, and then she felt so empowered, and it was just a terrific, you know, experience for her to be able to contribute like that, and then she was able to use that time to have other services, you know, people come and help her out with things that she needed help with. So it's just a really great program. There's a lot of, you know, small rural supplemental programs out there that are just, you know, doing things like this, and it's very, very nice to hear about.
Yeah,
thanks.
Great example.
Yeah,
very creative.
Yeah,
very creative solutions to very common problems that all communities have. Angelia, do we have any questions in the queue?
There are no questions at this time.
Okay.
Can we repeat the instructions on how to ask a question?
Again, to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad.
We'll give it just a minute to give you all an opportunity. This is your chance to talk with Aylin, Jenny, and Dennis about this topic today.
We have a question from the line of Renee Scott from Idaho.
Hi, thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go ahead, Renee.
Okay, I had a question. Being in a rural area, I've been interested in starting some type of a community thing like the trip or the Partners in Care. What do you do about screening the volunteers to make sure that the people who may be going in and out of these situations, is there a liability, or how do you screen that you're getting safe individuals to do that?
Well, let me go first on this one. It's interesting that one of the facets of the TRIP program is that the assumption that the person who is asking someone for a ride probably knows that person. So, you know, informally, you would think that a screening wouldn't be necessary. However, Florida recently passed some legislation that requires anyone who's working with seniors to have a level 2 background, criminal background check. So this is certainly has some implications for not only volunteer driver programs, but for volunteers in general. These screening programs cost $65, $70 each, and so it's definitely going to affect the volunteers. So I guess to answer your question directly, you may want to see if your state requires any type of background check for volunteers working with seniors.
Thank you, Dennis. And one of the thoughts that comes to my mind, this is Aylin, is it's one of the reasons to look up these resources that organizations that have tried to assist with how to organize these kinds of projects. They've put together toolkits and resource kits, and that's one of the reasons. So the TRIP program, actually, if you look it up, has materials, and it has suggestions that go through, and I wouldn't be surprised if it doesn't go through that section. And so and you'll find that with a number of these different resources that are out there, they're trying to help you anticipate some of those pitfalls and get things set up as best you can.
Absolutely. Thanks, Aylin. And I wanted to mention that here at the NCST, if you get in touch with us, we can put you in contact with people who've started programs or who run successful programs. They do have policies in place. You're not starting from scratch on any of this. More than likely, someone's already done it. So we are happy to put you in touch with them, and they are usually happy to turn over their policies, procedures. We have several things in the NCST library that are related to volunteer driving programs, and as I said, we can always put you in touch with others who've been in your same position.
Excellent. Okay. Any other questions today?
There are no further questions.
Okay. Great. So everyone's educated and confident, and you're going out to change the transportation world. We're all done. Okay, we're right at our time, so this is great. We just have a few minutes left before we end today's session. On behalf of my colleagues at the National Center on Senior Transportation, I'd like to thank our operator, Angelia, for all of her assistance today. And we'd especially like to extend our deepest gratitude to Aylin, Jenny, and Dennis for all their excellent work and sharing so much information with us.
And finally, thanks to everyone on the call. If you're applying for continuing education credits for your participation in today's webinar, please note that you must complete the post-test with a correct score of 80% or better, and you must complete the course evaluation and the AOTA CE Learner Survey. Links to all of these will be provided in a forthcoming email that will likely be from my email address, ltucker@easterseals.com. If you have any questions related to that process, please contact me there. It's also on the screen right now. If we were unable to get to your question today, you can also pose questions to the NCST staff at ncst@easterseals.com, or you can call our toll-free line at 866-528-6278. We are here to provide technical assistance to you guys for whatever you need related to senior transportation, so please don't hesitate to give us a call. If you're starting from scratch, that's fine. If you're advanced in your field, we'd love to hear what you're doing, so definitely get in touch with us and let us know what we can do to help. The PowerPoint, the audio, and a transcript of today's webinar will be available on our website, seniortransportation.net, in about 45 days. Again, thank you for your commitment to bringing together occupational therapy and the transportation industry to improve mobility options for older adults. Enjoy the rest of your day, everyone.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.